We love at No Film School to talk about filmmakers who came up the DIY indie style way, scraping by with less resources, finding a way to be creative and do things that amaze people and launch their careers. My guest today is a legendary example of this, the great Joe Dante. Joe Dante is a filmmaker behind so many classics, from Gremlins to The Burbs, which is one of my favorites, to Amazon Women on the Moon. If you haven't seen that, check it out. It's hilarious. Inner Space, the Twilight Zone movie that he worked on with Spielberg, among others, Matinee, and so many TV series. There's so much more that Joe's done in his career. He bends genre. He melds things. He's kind of a pastiche, postmodern style filmmaker, if you want to get snooty about it. He just has a great instinct, and he's a true cinephile. And today I'm talking to him about something he's doing with Shout Factory TV and Scream Factory TV, where he's picked 7 films on September 3rd that he feels are underseen, underappreciated classics. And we talk specifically about one on that list and how it's a great watch if you can get your hands on it, in terms of inspiring what you can do with less. But so much of what Joe's about, I mean, he came up with Roger Corman, which is where our conversation really begins, like James Cameron, among others, Jack Nicholson, so many. But so much of what Joe's about is how you stretch the dollar, how you get creative with limitations. And he even talks about how sometimes more money does indeed equal more problems. So we talk about the screening process. We talk about breaking into the industry. We talk about what's available to filmmakers today. And Joe is just a wealth of knowledge and film experience. So be sure to listen for the whole thing, because we'll also talk about a couple of things Joe's been working on that are just perfect No Film School audience tie-ins that I think you'll all really enjoy. So here we go. Joe Dante. Well, thank you so much for doing this, first of all. It's really exciting to have you. Honor to speak, have you on the show and speak with you. There's so much to talk about. You know, with No Film School, we try to be sort of educationally focused, and we have a big DIY independent film aspect to our culture and our history. And to me, you're one of the great, you know, voices in that, coming from working with Roger Corman. So I kind of want to just start with that and the beginning of your career, and just kind of hear a little bit about how you cut your teeth and how those early opportunities helped kind of define what you were going to do and how you do it.
Well, like a number of people, I was lucky enough to get to work for Roger Corman when I didn't know anything. the great leveler was that almost everybody that was working there was just starting out and was learning on the job. And in fact, on a couple of my movies, the people who were in different compartments, people who were in the art department or the sound department, suddenly decided that wasn't what they wanted to do at all. They wanted to do something else. They wanted to do costumes. They wanted, you know, it was a free for all atmosphere in which people discovered what their talents were. And we're allowed to, you know, exploit them to the degree of the budget allowed. And so, as you know, a lot of people went through that matriculation and came out on the other end as bona fide filmmakers with many times Academy Awards and things.
Yeah.
I wasn't one of those, but.
you did all right.
I had a picture that won an Academy Award for special effects, so I was happy. But the things you learned, obviously, there was how to stretch a dollar, how to make a decision, the importance of knowing what you were doing and not flailing around trying things that didn't work. So there was, considering how little money was really being spent, it felt like a tremendous amount of pressure to me. I mean, my first picture cost $60,000, and I thought $60,000. I mean, I wore those dollar signs on my shoulders like they were like a steamer trunk, because it was just a huge amount of money. and here, Alan Arkush and I had 10 days to make this movie on a bet the producer John Davison had made with Roger, saying that he could make the cheapest movie that he'd made at New World Pictures, and Roger said, "Okay, but you got to do it in 10 days." And the only way we could figure out how to make something releasable was to construct it around footage from movies that we've been cutting trailers for. And we knew all the action scenes.
Ah.
And dressing our actors up like the people in the clips. and then using them throughout the movie. And the gimmick was that it was supposed to be a movie about making movies. So Roger had been doing teachers who take their clothes off, nurses who take their clothes off, and now it was a movie about starlets who take their clothes off. And we wrote this movie about a movie company where there's murders. We stole the plot from a Bela Lugosi movie called The Death Kiss, and it was murders on a movie set. And we were able to use footage from all these different movie sites, fiction movies, war movies, 30s gangster movies, and justify them because they were all movies being made by this company. And so that's why people were dressed that way. And it was pretty inside. I mean, if you look at it today, it's almost a documentary about the way that low-budget movies were in Southern California in the 70s. But it was great for us because we got to, do everything and figure it out and edit it, try to make it work, and discover all the mistakes we made, which is the great thing about being able to edit your own material.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Have you ever wanted to watch something and it's just not available in your region? Have you ever been curious what UK Netflix or maybe some other country's version of some of the popular streamers has available that your local one doesn't? Well, there's something called NordVPN. And by using NordVPN, with the click of a button, you can access all kinds of content that maybe you didn't even know existed. With 5,000 plus server options, no show is out of your reach. So use my link, nordvpn.com/nofilmschool, and you can receive a huge discount on a 2-year plan plus one free month. We all love to binge shows, but privacy is a big deal too. NordVPN keeps your information encrypted, so you never have to worry about your IP or location getting out. We all love watching and streaming all these shows, but we also care about our privacy. And NordVPN keeps your information encrypted, so you never have to worry about your IP or location getting out. And they've also doubled down on keeping you safe with their new threat protection feature. So say goodbye to intrusive website ads and malware. Even if you download an infected file, threat protection will kick in and delete it before it makes a mess of your computer or whatever device you're using. So don't forget that there is actually no risk to you by trying this because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So give it a try. If you like it, great. If you don't, you get a full refund and you can pretend the whole thing never happened. Check out my link, nordvpn.com/nofilmschool. To get your subscription started today.
I feel like in a way, thinking about some of your other anthology pieces or some of the ways you combine comedy with horror aspects or just genre aspects throughout your career, it feels like that project kind of set up a certain tone. Did you just gravitate towards that or was it always in you? Because like I'm thinking about like Amazon Women on the Moon or even Police Squad doing some of those or even The Burbs and Gremlins, like it's just, Matinee, it feels like you gravitated towards like, I'm going to jumble it up, mix it up, reformat it, throw it back out. And it's going to be a little funny and a little crazy and a little scary. Like, you know what I mean? Like
that's sort of the way that I was experiencing movies. I mean, in my generation, we went to the movies on Saturday afternoon for a double feature and 10 cartoons. And then we went home and watched television, which more or less was either cartoons and movies. And so that was pretty much the way I experienced the world. So when it came time to put my limited worldview on film, it was naturally fragmented. And I've kind of carried that along with me for all these years. In every movie that I do, I try to filter through my own personality. And the bigger the budget, the harder it is to assert your personality. Because, of course, the temptation is for the people who are giving you the money. Well, don't make it too quirky. Don't make it too offbeat, because, you know, then everybody won't like it. And we want movies that everybody likes.
Which
I think is a fallacy. I think that the movies that are lasting movies are movies that were personal to the people who made them at the time.
That's a really interesting topic, because you talked about the challenges of the $60,000, but it felt like a lot. But also, like, the bigger the budget, the bigger the problems, sort of, or because the more voices, right, that come in.
And of course, I mean, I had the benefit of working for, you know, two people initially, Roger Corman and Steven Spielberg, two people that I could go to with a problem and who knew what I was talking about. And when you finally go up the ladder and now you're working for committees, you have a problem and you ask somebody and it goes up the ladder and you come down and there's an answer, but you don't even know whose answer it is or how it was arrived at. And so it's a lot harder. If you're working for people who really know movies, it just makes your job so much easier.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, like, collaboration with Spielberg, just because also somebody who I think probably experienced the world through that fragmented media reality, understood exactly what you were trying to do and what your tone and your perspective was, but just that you were like, could you just say, like, this is something I want to try to do? This is quirky and weird. And he would say, sure, do it. Or was it like, what was that dynamic?
That was pretty much the case. I mean, the thing about directors is that if you're a producer, is that you cast the director the way you would cast actors. You know, if you cast the right guy, then you can let him do what he's supposed to do. I mean, the mistake that I think studio people make is they hire people and then don't let them do their job. You know, they try to usurp them and do the job that I would do if I was in your job, except I can't because I don't know what you're doing. it can become a kind of a death spiral. And working for Steven and Roger was, they were collaborators. They wanted you to do good work. They obviously, there was a little more money when you're working for Steven than it was when you're working with Roger.
Sure.
But Spielberg was very supportive, to the point of even previewing the movies, not in work print form, but in finished form. He would let you finish the movie, mix it, put the sound on, do the music score, and all that kind of stuff, and then take it out and see how the movie fares at its best. And in most cases, they would, you know, you'd be previewing a scratchy work print, sometimes black and white with splices and cue marks and, you know, crayon marks all over it, and seen missing slugs, and the audience would of course not, whatever reaction the audience gave you would be not the real reaction they would get if they actually saw a finished movie. But Stephen just ran roughshod over that, and he finished the movies.
Because audiences don't know how to use that imagination, or probably executives a lot of times don't either, right? Because you're going to see a slug missing piece and you're going to think there's something wrong here subconsciously, like, right?
Well, it's just that you can't get into it. You can't follow it. There's no flow if you have to keep stopping it, you know? And there are very few executives in my experience who actually understood how to watch a rough cut and make the allowances that you need to make in order to see what the movie was supposed to be like, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
So in that case, and also, you know, the preview process is a terrifying process anyway, because you're putting your work out in front of people for the first time. And if somebody gets up to go to the bathroom during a scene that you argue the studio,
yes,
you gotta cut that scene. Look, I went to the bathroom.
Yes. I'm sure that's a nightmare. Just because that would hurt. That's confusing emotionally as an artist anyway, regardless of if it's a battle that you're already fighting with someone. And then that's going to be a point for them.
And also, they rely so much on these tests and test scores and stuff. I mean, I had an executive say to me after a really successful preview, well, let's see what the numbers say. You know, obviously the audience is like on their feet applauding the movie. Well, let's see what the numbers say. Because the numbers, you know, maybe they really didn't like it. It's difficult, and I think that's why studio filmmaking is very difficult for people now, particularly when there's so much more money riding on everything. It's difficult to be expressive, to be able to express your personality.
It's seemingly even harder now, maybe than ever before. Seems like to get through all the noise and to have that. But on the other end, there's all these like smaller audiences coming through streaming platforms and things like that, where they can kind of pick out what they want in a different way.
That's true. And also, if you're, you know, if you're an established filmmaker, like my friend George Miller, who I made the Twilight Zone movie with, he has a new movie out called The 3,000 Years of Longing.
Yes.
People expecting Fury Road 2 are going to be disappointed with, because it's not that kind of movie. But it is a beautiful, brilliantly made movie in the Michael Powell tradition. And I don't think that it's probably gotten enough press. I don't think it's gotten enough promotion. It's a very satisfying picture to watch, but there's no way it's going to do as well as his previous picture, because it's just not that kind of picture. But at least he got to make his movie his way.
Seems like they're having a hard time figuring out how to advertise it, right? They don't know how to tell people to go see it. They're seemingly confused.
They don't know what they have, and that's not the first time that's ever happened.
No. Heard that phrase before. It's interesting because you reference Michael Powell. You have this list of curated movies, and a lot of them are kind of like classic genres. Are these movies the ones you're doing the intros for? Is there a specific reason this is the collection that you're doing this with?
Well, they're all owned by Shout Factory, which is the obviously I can't just say, well, let's
you can't make anything out of it.
Let's do this Japanese monster.
Sure.
So yeah, I had to choose from the list of things they own, but they do own quite a few things, and been very good to me because they put out a lot of my work in upgraded editions and versions with documentaries, and they rescued a lot of found footage from explorers, which I never thought we would see. So that was great. But also their list is full of pictures that I was very familiar with already, and I thought, well, I'll just pick a couple of pictures that I think. That people probably heard the titles of, but they have probably never actually bothered to see them. Or maybe they're just curious about them, or maybe they're movies that I think they should see. I think they should know about. That's what I do on my website, Trailers from Hell. We try to, get people interested in movies that they might not have known about before. And on my podcast, it was the same thing.
This is the first I knew about the website and the podcast. So I'm excited to hear about that and let our audiences know, because people, to me, exposing people who want to do film or know more about film to more than just the standard classics or the things they've heard about is like the key to expanding the palette.
It is. It's the key to true cinephilia. And the website, which has been going on for about 10 years, is called Trailers from Hell, and it's movie trailers narrated by filmmakers, writers, directors, cameramen, whatever, all talking about what that movie means to them and what they think about it and why you should see it.
And I love that.
We've got over 2,000 trailers on the site.
Nice.
And some really great commentators. And they tell you, sometimes they're movies that they saw when they were kids. And the podcast is The Movies That Made Me, which I do with Josh Olson. And we have filmmakers on our show. And we talk a little bit about their work, but mostly they tell us the movies that made them want to make films. And so we get quite an eclectic bunch of.
I love that. That's oftentimes the first question I ask to people. I didn't ask to you today, but oftentimes I say, what's the movies that made you want to do this in the first place? So now I'm just going
to
ask you.
I'm
going to start listening, but what is that for you? What is the movie? What are the movies?
Well, there's no single movie. I mean, I was a Saturday matinee kid. I used to go to that. I was a huge Disney-phile. All the Disney comics, all the Disney cartoons, and cartoons in general. And so I went to the movies on Saturday to see the 10 cartoons. And then one day I stayed to see It Came from Outer Space in 3D. And I realized that maybe, even though they had adults in them, there were some movies that were kind of interesting. And that became my church. I used to spend weekends at the movies, much to the chagrin of my parents, my friend's parents, and became a film nut. I mean, there was no other way to, but I never thought I would make films because I thought it would be too complicated and hard. But I did want to be a cartoonist. So I thought, well, I'll just watch the 10 cartoons.
Which cartoons and cartoonists were the most impactful to you? Because sometimes I feel like that is an overlooked, I often think like Chuck Jones and some of the Warner Brothers stuff is an overlooked influence and inspiration to a lot of filmmaking trends that we've seen most popularized.
I think that's true. And when I was a kid, the 10 cartoons started out being, they spent money for the Disney cartoons and the Warner cartoons, which were the best. Then they started sneaking in a lot of Woody Woodpecker, which was okay. then when things got lean, there were a lot less of those, and there were more Paramount cartoons, and that's like Little Audrey and Little Lana, and Baby Huey. And it is horrible cartoons. Herman and... I mean, these are rotten cartoons, which you don't see these cartoons anymore. And
I've only seen a few. Most of those I've never heard of, but Baby Huey was like, okay, yeah, heard of that. No, Woody Woodpecker, obviously.
They were really
bad.
But, and there were some good Woody Woodpeckers because, Ted Savory went over there and did some stuff for Walter Lantz. And so there was a lot of good stuff being done. But then in the early to late 60s, things got really bad. Warner Brothers closed their shop and everybody had to go scrambling. And the last cartoons from Warner Brothers are pretty sad. And even the MGMs and the Tom and Jerry's, even when Chuck Jones went over to try to save Tom and Jerry, that didn't really work. And so the great cartoon era is over by, I would say, 1960. Precede that. And there are a few exceptions along the way. But once you get into junk like the Pink Panther and stuff that are, they hardly even move. They're literally TV cartoons.
It's that Xeroxy quality they have. Yeah. There's something so beautiful about the art, just the colors in the 50s and the 40s.
If you watch MeTV, which is on a lot of different markets, they have a cartoon show in the morning called Tune In With Me. And they have a lot of restored cartoons from the 40s and 30s that look more gorgeous now than they've ever looked before. Unfortunately, they're presented with the tops and bottoms cut off for the most part because they don't look widescreen. But they look fabulous. And there's a lot of restorations. The interesting thing about cartoons is that because of the racist nature of a lot of cartoons of that period, there's a whole bunch of them that they can't run because they just are completely out of step with the times. I mean, they're still interesting historically. And some of them are even brilliant, like Cole Black and the Seven Dwarfs. It's a brilliant cartoon. But try explaining it to someone today.
Yeah. It's
a rough one.
When HBO Max, I hope they don't end up pulling a lot of them, but they put so many of the classic Warners on and watch them with some of my younger son. And it's amazing the kinds of jokes that they could, like someone pulls out a gun and shoots somebody else. And you're like, oh my God. Like that's not something you've seen.
For a long time on the networks, they would reanimate that stuff. They couldn't put them on the networks because they'd have to have them pull out a pop gun or something like that.
And, right.
Luckily, I think most of those have been Deep Six. But look, I mean, these are different eras, and we have different standards now. But I think the old stuff is still beautifully done, and
it holds up well. And hearing that, it makes me realize how also just some of your humor. We have to wrap it up soon, but just thinking about the Burbs, it has so much cartoon comedy. That works for humans, but it's just, that is part of why I love it. Now I realize what the connection is. If you were giving someone advice today about getting in, especially given the challenges,
I'm often asked by film students, so how did you get started? And I always say, I can tell you how I got started, but it is completely irrelevant to you.
Yes.
Because that world doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
We were shooting on film. We were making things for drive-ins. We were, it's not the same market. And also the culture has changed to a point where the kind of movies that I started making, which were, for Roger Corman, like there were lots of movies.
Those aren't happening, right?
that's totally not happening. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just different. And so I think the great thing for people who want to make movies now is that, we had very cumbersome equipment when we had to shoot on film and we had to take it to the lab and edit it. And, you can do all that stuff on your phone. You can do it on your computer now. I mean, you can make, and movies have been made on iPhones, feature films, and you can do that. And all you need to do is have an idea and have some people, your friends or somebody to play in the picture and get an idea of what you can do on a small scale. One of the movies that we're running on the Shout series is called The Sadist, and it's a horror film set in a junkyard based on a real incident. And it's only got a cast of five or six, one of whom is the production manager, and it never leaves the junkyard. Plus, it takes place entirely in the time that it takes to watch the movie. And it's shot by Vilmos Zsigmond, is one of his early Hollywood movies. And it's a textbook example of what can be done with very little means. And it's a terrific watch. It's a terrific movie. And it's a template for what I think people can do if they really want to get together and put on a show.
It's a good point because the tools make it so much easier now than it would have been. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Going to check out the podcast and the website. I'm excited.
Please do.
Thank you so much for your time and congratulations on this. And we'll be checking it out.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Joe, for coming on the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I love that we talked about cartoons. I'm a big fan. It's just so funny how that ties into all his work. And I think you can see so much of what he's about and that influence in other filmmakers like Quentin Tarantino, for example, or the Coen brothers, or just so much of the stuff that I personally really love. I think Joe uses his experience as a cinephile, as he says, to filter all his ideas and stories. And for so many of us who get into this, that's our main thing, right? We love movies. So there's a way to be creative, to break through, to do different kinds of things, even if your main influence is just other movies. There's always going to be a place for you in this industry. And I personally felt when Joe started talking about what you can do with a cell phone, I was like, damn, why aren't more people just doing that? And I know I've thought about it a lot. We all have. We think about what we're capable of with so few resources these days. But when you consider what someone used to have to do to get an indie film made in his era, you realize it's just so much easier now. Now, the other question is, of course, will people see it? But that all depends on what you're doing. Be sure to check out all kinds of great filmmaking stories at nofilmschool.com. Like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. Please leave a comment and let us know what you think. Be sure to send your questions to editor@nofilmschool.com. We love to answer them on our weekly show, which usually comes out on Thursdays. And we love hearing from you. Also, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. We're doing some cool things on the socials lately, different than we've done before. So we'd love you to see all of that and comment or retweet or, you know, whatever you do with social media stuff. Wow, you made it all the way to the end. Have a great day.